Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And this is a conversation that was started in one of our post-episode conversations a few weeks back. And the idea is that the God of capitalism requires its human sacrifice.
Yep.
And this has been the case for this country for the entire time. And a lot of times we talk about slavery, but I wanted to, because it's relevant to where we are now, go back to the Great Depression. So in October 29th, 1929, it was a stock market crash. And that crash precipitated what we now know as the Great Depression. This period went on for over 12 years. And during that period, a lot of people lost jobs. People lost their homes. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they lost their lives. And there was not a lot of protection there for them. But the thing about the Great Depression, and we mentioned this a couple of episodes ago, they didn't call it that in 1929. This is one of those things that you have to look back on to see when it begins. Mm-hmm. And so after over a decade of this, people realize this is an event. Now, during the event, people didn't realize that they were living in that historical moment. You talk to or you listen to people who lived through that time, and they'll say things like, you know, yeah, we were poor, but we didn't know we were poor. Everyone mm-hmm. lived the same way. Most people just didn't have jobs and they had to hustle and grind and find new creative ways to live and exist. But that was just life for over 10 years. And so the reason why this is relevant now is because in the Great Depression, the unemployment rate peaked at 24.9%. As of this mm-hmm. week, we hit 26.6 million jobs lost. So that looks a lot like year one of the Great Depression, where the unemployment mm-hmm. rate was 8.7%. 24.9% is the height of unemployment, but it went from 8.7 to 15.9 to 23.6. So it went up. So in year mm-hmm. one, we're approaching levels and probably will surpass levels comparable to year one of the Great Depression.
Right.
So not knowing when the start begins, that started with the stock market crash of 1929. Right now, we're starting with a virus, and that virus is going to have lasting effects. And the thing that this country has always done effectively is to make the money to appease the God of capitalism. This country will throw any bodies at it that it can find.
Exactly. Any available bodies. And I mean, let's just frame this up a little bit more for our listeners. It is not the singular event. So you have the actual market crash, which occurred, I believe, over 2 days and impacted people's behavior, people's consumer behavior and people's investment behavior were affected. And if you know anything about our markets and our market system, you basically have the consumer class and the wealth creation investor class. So both sides of the spectrum were rocked at the same time for two totally different reasons. And that means that there were two realities going through the Great Depression of the 1930s. It's pretty much the same way, and it's going to unfold the same way, and it's going to unfold across years the same way. However, there's a set of factors that lead up to that one clarion event, and we've met the test for those factors. So we are offering this episode so that, you know, you can understand for yourself that you're not making it up. You're not being overly critical of your leaders or overly sensitive to your environment or to your finances, or even overly anxious, if not depressed, if not, you know, feeling, you know, even stripes of helplessness when you're assessing your situation. Because the truth of the matter is we've hit all the qualifying factors, and we really need to talk about how capitalism almost requires this of the people who operate under the system. So that's where we are.
The God of capitalism is a system that demands its sacrifice, and the appetite grows in proportion to the system. So the more hungry the system is, the more bodies we need to throw at it.
Exactly.
We've done this with indigenous peoples and Asians and Hispanics initially in this country. We've done it with black bodies through slavery.
I've always posited that the system requires fuel. And when you look at this in terms of just people, capitalism requires a huge sacrifice of its participants, especially the participants who are at the lower rungs of society. And that could be due to their actual wealth, or it could be due in a society like America and like the Western world. It could be due to how they present to the world. So how they look, where they live, their own religious practices. It's this hierarchy that is not really meant to be overcome, even though you do have examples of people doing much better within the system. The problem is when this particular system is harmed in some way. The system is going to want to protect itself. And I believe that only those who are wanting to pay attention and open to seeing how a system works and how we work within it can see when capitalism says, I'm hungry. So to the point that we've talked about how did capitalism, you know, touch indigenous people. The Trail of Tears does not happen if there was not an inherent value, not just in the cruelty of removing indigenous people to faraway lands, but if there was no value in the land that they were sitting on, I do not believe that the Trail of Tears looks the same way. So this is an outstanding example that comes kind of later in the development of these American government and indigenous governments and indigenous peoples, these relations. Our ability or our history of misrepresenting our intent, our history of misrepresenting the terms of agreement, our treaties with these nations. These were nations. These were not just, you know, people sitting around in huts and teepees and stereotypical things that people think about so-called quote unquote Indians. It wasn't that. These were nations, fully functioning societies, and they were systematically removed for capitalism's gain. One of the first things that happened prior to implementing a slavery system, Europeans attempted to use indigenous slave labor. A lot of those nations and those people did not survive. They were consumed in silver mines and gold mines. They were consumed in clearing land and creating a large agrarian-based society out of what had previously been someone else's possessions. So that's an example of just showing how it wasn't just the hearts of people or the individual discriminatory acts of a person or a group of people that led to harm. It was the fact that in growing America's ability to create wealth, the cost that had to be paid, the cost that was kind of pushed down the line, was to those people least able to afford it. That is an example. That's the canary in the mine for every other group that has come after indigenous people. When we talk about what happened to Asian groups and what happened to indigenous persons who were under different colonial rule, it all comes together to show that these were the first bodies consumed by this emerging capitalist system. As we converted from mercantilism to capitalism classic, you have the emergence of the slave trade and the implementation of a slave labor system throughout the New World that was not meant to expose African-rooted people to a new way of life that was positive for them. It was meant to zero out a large part of the cost that it takes to establish business to earn money. If you zero out your labor costs, most of us negotiate a salary, a raise, you know, cost of living. What do we argue about? What do we want from our employers? These types of demands are rooted in the fact that a great amount of wealth was created without having to pay the people who did the work. We know very well the horrors of slavery. We know and still are discovering them, it seems like weekly, every day. Every day there's a new example. There's a new link in the history that we can study and hopefully face and hopefully confront and reconcile and ultimately heal. But at the core of it is the fact that Africa was opened up for Europe and its colonial entities and these newer European-led countries that had just finished decimating or were in the process of decimating indigenous groups, Africa was opened up to fuel this growing monster and beast.
We see this and we know this. It's something that we benefit from, all of us, including us. So I'm not speaking of this in terms of like, that's them over there. Someone's bringing my orange juice to the shelves so I can buy it during this event, and I'm benefiting from that. It reminds me of a movie that was based on a French novel. The movie's called Snowpiercer, and it's about to be a series, which I'm very excited about. But
Looks great. But go ahead.
Right. In that movie, we failed against global warming, and the Earth had frozen over. And so one of the last vestiges of humanity was this train built by this company. Snowpiercer was the train. And in the train, there's all these cars of human life. And so you have a car where there's children being educated. And then you have a car where rich people are eating and things like that. And then in one car, you see all of these poor people. They're dingy, they're coal-soaked clothes. And this is the image that we have of how humanity works. So these people make the train run. And so they get the scraps. They don't get food. They get like this gelatinous thing that's produced. And it's an incredible take on humanity in this one environment of this train. And so we know that. Like if you see, even when trains used to run, coal trains, the conductor was shoveling coal into, or the engineer was shoveling coal into the train. So the other rich people could ride in comfort. That was the person that was messing up their respiratory system and eventually died before all those people on the train. And that's kind of how the movie works. But capitalism requires that body to produce, to actually give itself fully to the enterprise so that other people can be in comfort. Our system is set up in different ways to allow that. So we had, you mentioned slavery. We've talked on this show about mass incarceration and how that's used through the prison labor system to produce genes and fast food containers and all of these things that we use every day that are fueled by this cheap labor that we see the results of that in our streets. When police have to over-police certain areas to keep fueling that machine.
Right.
We see that in our education systems as people are forcibly not educated. We talked on the Brown versus Board of Education show about how that system is set up to be broken and how it operates. And the result is people who cannot support themselves because they don't have the tools to know how to move or navigate the world. A lot of times they'll end up in that prison population to produce that cheap good that can get sold to that billion-dollar conglomerate and get put back on our shelves and on our backs. And so the system is never not operated that way.
Never. I mean, again, just for example, like when we talk about the industrial consumption of, so capitalism as a system that's fueling not only the wealth creation in our society, but it's present in everything that we do. Like even currently with the quarantines and the temporary shutdowns, you have whole industries that are being affected, but truly, they're about consumption. They're about goods, you know, goods and services and consumption. I understand that people are coping and they do want to get back to a sense of normalcy and get back to a quote regular life. But we really should interrogate what we thought or what we think is regular. Essential workers, this floating definition of what it means to be essential. 9 times out of 10, that's for the benefit of the organization. Let's just be for real. Because I don't know that it's on the same level that the, you know, cashier at a supermarket is essential to the point of losing their life as, let's say, the police officer or the doctor who understands the engagement and understands the value of their particular sacrifice. And maybe they don't, but I just think that that is offhand. The ER doctor or the nurse that is serving in the heart of this pandemic and being on those front lines, and their lives are on the line, and understanding that there's value to every life, organizations are sitting back and saying, yes, right along with that doctor or nurse, we need to put out the supermarket handler. We need to put out the street sweeper, the trash collector. And sometimes we just don't think about what that is, because we don't want to lose everything at one time, but trust and believe there's a cost.
I want to distinguish between essential workers and people who essentially have to work. That's two different things.
Mm. So, absolutely.
That's how the categories are defined. And that's how you see the value assigned to a life. Because let's say that doctor that you mentioned is an essential worker. But even outside of the event, they get paid like they're an essential worker. And for an essential worker, anyone who knows mm-hmm. that they're mission essential, they understand that they're getting money because when an event happens, they need to be called upon. And so that's part of the mental sacrifice. Now, for the people who essentially have to work, they don't get the money outside. What's happened is they've been impoverished so that they must work when the time comes. Right. And so that value proposition placed on the different sets of lives that we're seeing that playing out now, the person who runs the power companies or the water companies mm-hmm. so that the doctors can have what they need to, they would fall in the essential worker category, because if they're not there, then those things don't happen. But the person that is working at the grocery store, I don't know that they view themselves as essential more than, if I don't do this, I'm not going to be able to live.
I will not be able to work. But again, I feel like that person operates from their perspective and their understanding of their personal situation, but none of it is not without design and not without intention. The organization establishes who is essential according to their own needs. So some things will not be as flexible or may not make as much sense on their face, but ultimately we're all contributing to the same overall economy. And I think that in these times of downturn, people begin to ask themselves question about value and worth. And this is kind of where we are. And this is what is guiding this conversation, because if you felt like that everyone might not be being treated the same according to what it is they do and where they live and how people participate in their businesses, you are not making that up. That is the American way.
So we're seeing the system is weakened because of this event. And so the vulnerable are the first bodies into the fray here. And so we see those persons who are poor that cannot opt out of working right now or cannot work a different way. They're on those front lines.
Right.
Seniors right now are getting slaughtered. Anyone in assisted living or nursing homes, they almost make up one quarter of the deaths and cases in the country right now.
Yes. And the situation is so dire and multifaceted, because we are in this environment, and we acknowledged this a couple of episodes ago, that this is affecting our regular communal practices and patterns. So even if your elder is in that environment and has not passed, you might still be fretful because policies are currently in place that say, oh, you can't visit. You're not there to offer your assistance to them, your support to them directly. I have a family member who is basically still acting as a caregiver to someone who lives in an assisted living home, and she is not able to operate in her regular capacity, and she's going crazy because she knows that the level of care that she added to whatever she found there is what made her comfortable with the situation. So we're being separated from some of our kin that are now impacted by policies. But it should not be lost on anyone that the nursing home industry in 2018 lobbied for less regulation of their standards of cleanliness and their standards on staffing and their standards on how they interact with other aspects of a local or regional health system. All of this, here you have this pandemic factor. It's this outside factor. It's the dark horse, but it has come to expose the real cost of that lobbying. So on Capitol Hill, you work that out. On Capitol Hill, you send lawyers to talk to lawmakers who then suggest all manner of things that the average person could not do. The lawmakers might make a suggestion in our system that has become very convoluted. Oh, you know what? You should go to this dinner. You should go to this fundraiser. And said lobbyist representing said organization does that. And it helps them further their ability to impact how laws are written to impact their business. Not to so much make it better, though. Under the guise of making it better, 9 times out of 10, a law or policy is going to get passed that makes somebody richer, that makes them richer for doing less work. I don't know if there is a better example that lines up with, let's say, the plantation type of economy, where for every example of a planter or a member of the planter class who had for themselves an experience in actually working their fields, you had a great many more who had inherited and were looking for a way to increase their wealth and decrease their output and decrease their liabilities. So we have a history of business in this country. And sometimes I feel like the history of business in this country is obscured by conversations about slavery or conversations about women's rights. It's the history of business.
So economists don't know. They can't pin down a singular cause for the Great Depression because there was none. The stock market crash precipitated it, but it was the result of a collection of failures and systems not being in place to protect. And so right now we've seen leading up to this point, the deregulation that's happened, the dismantling of the public school system and education system.
Yeah, the weakening. There's been a weakening of our ability to respond. Mm-hmm. And I've been calling this period the Great Exposure because everything has happened so fast that if you were not ready, you do not have an opportunity to get ready. So we're not even talking about, you know, the personal, the individual's ability to prepare, let's say, to hunker down. You know, weeks ago, we saw the runs on at supermarkets on water, toilet paper, paper towels, disinfectants, and the like. That had a lot to do with either one, the people who said, wow, this is really important. Let me go and get what my family needs, or let me go and get what those people who rely on me will need from me. You know, let me jump into the fray. That's a consumer. There were other people who were in the midst of all of that panic and pandemonium who saw an opportunity to earn or make a quick buck. And without saying whether or not they are right or they are wrong, what I will say is that they are a capitalist. How you feel about them operating within the system at their level to do so is how you feel. But it shows up all the time. We do not have an issue with gentrification if there is not a process in place for people to purchase a property or purchase land and experience no appreciation, not due to market forces, but due to the design of the market and the design of who gets to participate in it. There's no way that the house was worth nothing when it was yours and it's worth, you know, $1 million when it falls into the hands of somebody else. There's no way.
Kitchen cabinets in it now, all of a sudden, the value's increased.
Exactly. Or, you know, certain people move in your neighborhood and all of a sudden the values have increased or decreased. That has very little to do with the actual quality of the home. It has everything to do with the design of what we intend the neighborhood to look like. And we know that these are the building blocks of other aspects of our society. The design of how I want that neighborhood to look impacts the design of how that zip code looks, which impacts the design of, let's say, how that county looks. Eventually, when that level of design, that urban, let's say that urban design or whatever, comes into play with the economy or comes into play with the voting system, that's how we determine how rich or how poor an area is, how blue or how red it is, or, you know, what is the political pulse point on that area. So even if things seem mindless, I just feel like there's a great amount of intention at every level of the machine to ensure that it sustains itself.
Right. And we're seeing that now. So Georgia just opened up because the God needs bodies. The God needs sacrifice.
The God needs bodies. And it needs bodies dead or alive. Right. Let's be clear.
Dead or alive. It just needs bodies chucked into the system onto the altar. Mm-hmm. And so Maryland just announced that they're opening up in May. This is an experiment to appease the system, to mm-hmm. to make sure that we mm-hmm. can regenerate or restart the thing that had been shut down. So the question for us is, how do we protect ourselves against a system that demands us as the sacrifice? Because none of us listening or in, you know, on the mics are on that, on mm-hmm. the side of this where we can dictate what happens.
Right.
Unless we're dictating within our very small sphere of life, we can make some choices there. But what mm-hmm. can we do, or how do we protect ourselves?
Well, I think one thing that I would like to call attention to is the fact that nature, you know, in our inability to move about our regular environment and do our regular things, we have these examples emerging in nature of reclamation. And I just think that is a cue. I'm not telling everybody to, you know, go out and burn your paper money and, you know, stop using the trappings of modernity or anything like that. I'm just saying, look at that, right? Because I have never experienced a time period like this in my life where my time or the opportunity to recalibrate my time was just dropped in my lap. I have not ever experienced an opportunity such as what has been presented to really articulate and demonstrate what I mean when I say family comes first, or to articulate and demonstrate what my true values and beliefs might be. Because right now, I do not even have to commute, right? I have to manage my work from home, and I'm thankful that I can do so. But it's made me acutely aware of my sacrifice of time to the beast. I think that this is a great time to pay attention to where we're making our investment versus what we're consuming. And I just think that's just a point of guideline. You know, if you are investing these moments in your family, investing these moments, if you like, into self-improvement, or if you are investing in making sure that you are healthy and whole and able to participate for as long as you can, that is important. Because if you're caught up in the daily grind, you can lose months, if not years, of your life not paying attention to the fact that you're not living. And I just think that moving yourself back into the center of your story, and moving yourself back in, yourself and your family back into the center of your goals and your intent and your and how you utilize your time, is a great first step, or a great step to take. Because I don't think it will ever be like this again. This is the first time I've experienced it. But then again, I'm looking at a life like my grandmother's. This is her third depression or recession. Mm. So who's to say? I also believe that, much to the tenor of the advice that has been floating around, okay, free, everybody got 2 cents and they're throwing it everywhere. I just think that it is good to be prepared and not panicked. Because again, relating this to behavior, when you buy things under pressure, you usually pay too much for them. And you usually take what you can get and not what you need. So this is a word to the wise about being prepared. And it's not even about, you know, items. It's about wills. It's about, like, we have to get serious about using some of the mechanisms and measures that are in place that maybe we underutilize. I can't think of anything more important right now than life insurance, a will, and a living will, so that people will know what to do in case you are not able to speak for yourself.
That insurance is so critical. You can buy it right now if you got the money. I mean, so that being prepared matters so much. So we opened the show speaking about the Great Depression. During that time, there were people who the banks closed on them, and the money that mm-hmm. they had in the banks, they were unable to retrieve. The banks never opened back up. A lot of people just could not pay. And there was no mm-hmm. mercy given from the landlords and things like that. So a lot of people lost their homes that way. And so you, like, for me, I'm asking myself now, who holds my money better right now? Mm-hmm. I mean, is the bank better at holding my money than me right now? I mean, they're not giving me a lot of return on savings. Why is the money there and not with me? Things like that, like, in terms of you make a great point in terms of being prepared with wills and things like that. And also, on the practical side, there are things that you can do. Like, you may be fortunate enough to be working now. That does not guarantee that you will be working in a month or 3 months. Mm-hmm. So whatever you have, it's important to hold because you don't know what you'll need.
Exactly.
The thing about the Great Depression that makes this especially relevant right now is because that period birthed a lot of American ideas, or ideas that we consider American. Mm-hmm. Like, we're seeing at first, when this first started, we were seeing like a lot of creative videos and things like that. People doing voiceovers, TikTok and all that stuff. And people were like, wow, this creativity is great. That's what happened during the Great Depression. The reason that happened is because everyone was poor, because there wasn't much to do, they needed that escapism. And that escapism came, one of those ways came in the form of cinema, which it existed, but it didn't become a big business until after or during and after the Great Depression. Hollywood was not the Hollywood mm-hmm. that we know now until the Great Depression. They didn't need to watch Fred Astaire right. and Ginger Rogers on these elaborate sets and doing all this when everyone didn't have any money. But people watched it because they needed it. And so that creativity birthed Hollywood. Necessity birthed the unions, which have been mm-hmm. systematically dismantled for the past 20 yes. years. But before yep. the Great Depression, the unions did not exist. But the workers, because of all of that unemployment, they needed protection. And so the unions came into place. Social programs like Social Security, yes. because they didn't have that safety net. Social Security came in place because of the Great Depression.
And also the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So it's to your point about the bank run, when we say that it wasn't just the one day on the market, the bank run happened first. People heard rumors that they needed to get their cash out of the bank. And when all of the depositors showed up, each bank did not have enough cash on hand to give you back your $500, your $1,000. I mean, these are huge sums in the 1920s. They did not have the cash on hand, which led to those bank closures. And if you weren't, you know, first in line to get your money, there was no recourse. So it definitely compounded the impact of losing your job due to stock market trembles and earthquakes. And then you go to the bank to retrieve your savings and the bank has closed because they had to give out more cash than they had on hand. The FDIC, which we see all the time on like mm-hmm. bank commercials or when you log in, it was created to secure your deposits up to $250,000 per bank branch that you go to. So anybody who's ever dealt, like, once upon a time in my story career, I dealt with endowments, and I learned that even if you had a multi-million dollar endowment, if you were not going to hold it in specific instruments, you would have to go to various branches of the bank with up to $250,000 of that multi-million dollar amount so that the bank could insure your deposit. So this was directly born to protect consumers interacting with their banks. And this was a direct result of the Great Depression.
And the last thing that I want to bring up that's a result of the Great Depression is the reason why those social reforms happened. FDR, yep. in his presidential campaign run in 1932, mm-hmm. leading up to that election where he served 3 terms, one of his chief questions of his campaign was, why are these people not in the streets with all of this destitution and none of these protections and no one helping them? Why are they not out making a big deal about this? Mm-hmm. Now, that got him elected. And then those social programs ended up coming into place over a period of years. In our situation, it's a little bit different. Because you can't really be out in the streets protesting when the issue is a virus that's highly contagious and highly lethal. But mm-hmm. that ethos should be with us. How do we do this? We are lucky enough right. to be on the precipice of another election. Your census should be filled out. Your absentee ballot should be turned in.
Yes.
All of these things should happen now, because if you can't be in the streets, that doesn't mean you can't be effective. The world right. changed after that event. And in a lot of ways, it changed for the better. Unions, protect mm-hmm. union protections, pensions, Social Security, like you said, FDIC, all of these things helped us. Even Hollywood, that escapism, we live off of that.
Yeah. And FDR was able to implement the New Deal. So part of why he stayed, he's the only president that we have had that has had three terms. And the current president, whatever, but he wants to be a three-term president for all the wrong reasons. And I do not believe that this will spur him into that position. What I believe is that he's going to have the fate of Hoover, which he too was caught flat-footed, very much so catering to only one part of society and very much so catering to only one part of the electorate. And there was no space for an expansion of his vision. He had painted himself into the corner. History repeats itself. You don't know what's going on, it's going to repeat itself. What FDR did for America was that he designed a work program that put Americans back to work in various different ways. So a lot of our infrastructure, people have heard the word infrastructure flying around. Congress needs to do something about infrastructure. They absolutely do. It would be great if we were informed on the examples that we have that they could replicate. So the New Deal did that. It established government programs that put people back to work. And just to connect all of these dots, without his New Deal, we do not have a canon of firsthand accounts of Black Americans who were living in the 19th century, some of whom were actually slaves. So through the Writers Program, they went around to rural areas and reached into very isolated communities and conducted interviews with persons and just asking them questions. What has life been like? What was it like prior to? What is it like now? You know, what would you like to offer into the record? Is there anything interesting about you? And we now have a set of writings. You know, we always talk about primary sources and everything else. These are primary sources of people who really, through their testimony and through their affidavit, offered us a bridge from the antebellum South to, let's say, America in the late 1930s, or America on the precipice of World War II. Huge, important work that has never been replicated at that level again. His works programs are also responsible for great many development projects throughout the country, but especially in the West. These are just ideas. Nobody would have to recreate the wheel, but there is something that has to be present, and that's intention. And just due to our system, you have to have political will. And increasingly, you're going to have the will and the input and the fair participation of the investor class to spurn productivity and opportunity and protection amongst the consumer class. So it remains to be seen, but that's where we are. And none of this is hopeless, but you have to be very, very serious about what you're going to do to make things better.
So we've covered how the God gets hungry. We've covered that the God is weakened. This is a powerful God, but this God is not all powerful. This God is not invincible. This God has lost before. The fact that this God is hungry means this God can be beat. Now, this God comes back. And so that means we have to be vigilant in how we defeat this God. But for now, the immediate goal is to protect you and your loved ones from being thrown on the altar. As these states start to reopen to generate wealth and strengthen that God again. So just consider the creative ways you can do that. Just consider how you can protect yourself and your loved ones as we move forward, and then dream like how we can be different, how we can be better. The things that they put in place after the Great Depression, those are the things that if you zoom back out of our political lens for the last 5 to 10 years have been fought for, like this battles about entitlements and things like that, because those things will be eroded away. So how do we put things in place that will last, and how do we continue to fight for them, and how do we maintain our understanding of history so that we don't keep repeating the same cycle the next time that God gets hungry? So consider all these things. Be safe. Take care of yourselves. For Faith Uncut, I'm your host Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.